because I was became dehydrated, and I was having some problems with my heart slowing down. So anyway, I went into so then they came into the they called me at the hospital and they said, can you just hang on a little bit longer? I said, well, you know, it's so I wound up going to the Board of Supervisors, got out of the hospital, went into a wheelchair, and at that point they had approved the site, and then there was a day or so delay, but Paige and Paulie said, well, we're going to open it right away. So I think it opened December 19th or something like that.
And that was, of course, was the Cedar Street Cold and Rainy Night Shelter, which
right.
actually let people in on an emergency basis without case management, without a waiting list.
Exactly.
They just crammed everybody in who came, right?
Yeah, right. And they originally said it was only going to be 25, but I think the first night, which was kind of a cold and rainy night, there was like 65 or 70 people in there.
And the, I guess this lasted only for one season, right?
It lasted, but out of that came an effort, particularly spearheaded by Paige Smith, to organize and purchase a new site for a permanent shelter. And so the first one they found was over there by Potrero, and that all fell through. So we were hoping that when the people left the Cedar Street shelter that they could go to that permanent shelter, but that wasn't the case. And so when they had to leave the temporary shelter on Cedar Street, they were back on the street again, and the city and county kept messing around. So then it came November, and
1985.
Right, and they had we had to do it again, but this time
another fast.
Exactly, mm-hmm. But we had many people that time. Then we had Linda LeMaster. There was a group of people. There was a man, and so that time it was much more public. It was a lot more support.
Was the camping ban involved in this at all?
Yes, I think it was. It was like we were talking in terms of trying to get them to reopen, to try to begin negotiations, because apparently they had started negotiations on the site that they presently have. I guess it's still there, the River Street Shelter.
You know, what I call the River Street Mini Shelter. It's a kind of a managed program for 36 people at the corner of River and Highway 1.
Right. And negotiations had broke down on that, and so we had asked that they resume negotiations, and then we brought up the issue of, you know, allowing people to camp here, there, and everywhere, or designated sites, you know. And so, I mean, I was particularly supportive of any kind of a per se campground, but as you well know. So.
Well, we'll hear more about that, I hope.
Yes.
So you fasted for how long was the first fast?
I think it was about 30 or 31 days.
And the second one?
It was about 30 or 31 days.
I
32
see.
Days.
So they didn't, and they finally relented and let that property, be used to set up the shelter?
Yes, they finally purchased it.
Mm-hmm.
So that was, a big thing, and so then there was, but in the meantime, until it got renovated, they opened up another temporary shelter, which was called the Peter Pan Shelter down in the Beach Flats,
mm-hmm.
And so the people were able to spend the winter there.
Now this only served a tiny fraction of the homeless population, right?
Oh yeah, right.
And what were police doing at the same time as this was going on around the camping ordinance and the sleeping ban sections of the camping?
Well, for the most part, they were raiding the campsites. They had that horse posse, and they would go in and, you know, destroy camps and, you know, or then take people off to jail. It's pretty much their operation.
1987, I believe you ran for sheriff of the county?
Was it 80? I think it was 86.
86.
Right.
And how did you do there, and what were you trying to accomplish?
Well, essentially what I was trying to accomplish was to continue the platform for bringing homeless issues to the forefront. And when we had when we began to have serious discussions again after we got the River Street Shelter kind of in place after the second hunger strike, and Fred Gray and I, who was another activist in town, were having a conversation with one of the supervisors, whose name slips me, but he was the supervisor for San Lorenzo Valley. And he said, well, if you had anything out in San Lorenzo Valley, you'd have to have guards to protect you from the sheriff's deputies. And I said, the light bulb went off. And so I said, what you're essentially saying and owing up to is something we suspected for a long time, that they were behind, these trashing of the campsites and all that. So that kind of set the wheel in motion for running for sheriff.
How many votes did you get?
I don't know, but I think I did pretty good. I didn't win.
Yeah, I think it was a couple thousand, but I could
I
be wrong.
Was, yes.
Now, and then the next year, I guess a couple years after that, you ran for city council.
Right. Uh-huh. And that, once again, that was to keep the issue of the homeless in the forefront. And I will say there was like 17 candidates that time. And, homelessness dominated the agenda.
Well, at that time that was actually when I kind of started taking a part in these protests. I started the petition for homeless rights.
Right.
And we began the meals at city council every 2 weeks, which eventually resulted in the police coming and the health department trying to shut us down.
Oh, yes.
Not because there was anything shown to be unhealthy or people were sick or there were bad preparation conditions, but I think primarily as a political device to make sure homeless people didn't gather. What was your reading on that?
Oh, I definitely think that's correct. And if they gathered, it was only under their, where they wanted them to be at the particular time. And if you, remember correctly, when we started it at the clock and then they started up negotiations and then the city took it over for 1 month. And it was like, it was for a Christmas gift, I guess.
Yeah, they ran their own meal. They took over the meal for, you did a kind of a Thanksgiving Christmas parade where there was a...
Oh, yes, the Bag Ladies Revolt, right.
You did this thing called Bag Ladies Revolt, which had you and Linda and Shannon and others. And I guess Mayor then Marty Wormhout, now one of our august supervisors, was so upset with you that she sent in the police to make sure you didn't do a vigil at the town clock, which you were serving hot soup. And this was about the camping ban and about violence against the homeless?
Exactly. And if you remember correctly, the reason we did the Bag Ladies Revolt was because we had tried to work with the Downtown Association around the whole issue of Christmas and donations and everything. And so what they wound up doing was to have people to see Santa Claus. You could bring in a can of food, but this food was not going to go directly to the homeless. It was going to go to the River Street Shelter, who didn't even have a kitchen in those days.
Mm-hmm.
So we said, no thank you. If you want to help the homeless, we'll set up a soup kitchen at the clock, and you can just bring your contributions there. And that's kind of what... And then plus we'd had a whole rash of beatings and right after the elections. I'm not sure what that was all about, but there was some really bad stuff went on.
In those elections, it was when Don Lane, Mo Reisch, and Marty Wormhout, I guess, were... No, Marty was already on the council.
Yeah, it was the other woman.
Jane Yokoyama.
Yeah.
She was elected.
Yeah.
And I guess that was when Catherine Byers came in, because Mo resigned. Catherine Byers then, in 1989, was appointed. And it was during the 1989... I know we're maybe a little slow on running through all this stuff, but it was when you had the infamous... we had a lot of... I guess Mitch Snyder came to town, the national homeless activist, and there was concern about, in the early days of 1989, there was massive arrests for serving free food, and we formed the organization SWAP, Soup Without a Permit. Sandra Loringer was tried in the summer of 1989 and convicted and sent to jail after a jury trial for serving free food. Various other people were also up for trial. Joe Schultz, who was then master chef of India Joe's restaurant and still contributes food, although he's no longer the owner of the restaurant, doesn't operate out of that restaurant anymore. He still contributes to homeless causes in terms of coming down there with his bucket of soup, and that's happened a lot in the last few months.
Mm-hmm.
You yourself, I guess, then became involved in, you finally, the city council relented after first getting angered by one of my flyers and refusing to set up...
And I put you up to sending in,
that
right?
You were the master hand behind that.
the reason was because I didn't like the agreement, because they wanted security guards and high fences, and I said, no way.
Right. Well, You know, we could follow this sort of line by line and blow by blow, but if you were to look over the you know, events between then and now, which are the most significant that, sorry, that you were involved in?
What was the most significant that I was involved in?
Following, I mean, I know that you, in 1989, you were eventually, you had kind of a love feast with Mayor Wormhout. You went to Washington for Housing Now. You started serving people food out at the, what became, I guess it was Calamity's Cupboard. You called yourself Calamity Jane in those days.
Yes, right.
And then you had the earthquake, and of course people who had been made newly homeless were given the royal red carpet treatment. Those who had previously been homeless were pretty much treated in pretty much the same vicious way as before. I remember them arresting people in front of the Civic Center auditorium, which was being used as a shelter. And over the objections of the manager, he said, don't arrest these homeless people. The shelter is full, but... I remember Officer Jim Howes arresting, what was her name with her dog, Karen, anyway, it was a woman with a dog who was trying to sleep on the steps because she had no legal place to go. And but anyway, those are sort of the high points in my mind. Then in 1990, you closed down Calamity's Cupboard saying we don't have a certified kitchen, and we began kind of occupying kitchens all over the city trying to make the city and county fulfill its promises. And I guess they didn't give you the kitchen. Instead, they recruited your assistant, Karen Gillette,
right,
who then became the fair-haired woman of the homeless services industry. And she started a thing called a free meal and became the head of the Homeless Community Resource Center and became a very powerful figure locally in homeless services. And I think finally she was eased out a year ago when I guess Catherine Byers started having doubts about her. Not so much her integrity as her ability to handle a large homeless services situation, and they brought in a guy called Ken Cole from Seattle, who's now taken her place. But as for you, you know, we're talking about changes in the sleeping ban sections of the camping ordinance, and also we're talking about the whole camping ban. Mm-hmm. And what I've been telling folks is that the camping ban is still everywhere in place in Santa Cruz, and will be, even if the City Council on June 13th ratifies this new partial repeal. What it does is, as you probably know, is it sets up two zones where vehicles can park and people indeed can sleep on the sidewalk, though there's not much else, or actually in private property around the city with the permission of the owner. That's also allowed, and that's something of a change, although currently it's legal to sleep in a side yard or a backyard if the side yard is fenced in. You've always been a critic of camping, sort of controlled campgrounds. I know that back in 1990, the City Council considered a proposal by Sherry Connable and with her, I guess it was a Coalition for a Safe Place to Sleep, and there was a kind of a big move and a protest for 10 days by that group to set up a little piece of, you know, a little part of parcel of property as a campground. You want to talk a little bit about what is the solution for folks in Santa Cruz? We have 700 to 1,500 homeless people here, as you know. They aren't going away. Their housing is obviously not going to be built. What should be the temporary response here? We said they can sleep, but sleeping on the sidewalks in certain small zones, to me, is obviously no solution to that. I mean, it's a way of saying at least you're not going to get arrested, so it's, I suppose, a step forward in that regard. But, you know, it doesn't do it. What do you suggest?
I think, I agree with you. I think that is a step forward. But I do think that, you know, it can't just stop there. And I do oppose any kind of a large organized campground because I think it would turn out to be a disaster. We saw that, at one point early on, I think I supported that. I mean, we go back into the 80s at that point. But just in observing various groups and what happened back there at the River Street campground, it was sort of disaster.
You're talking about Coral Street Open Air Shelter, perhaps?
Yeah, right. I just think it would be better if we would just have, you know, people would be allowed to lay their bag down or their blanket down as long as it's not on somebody's doorstep. You know, maybe you can have designated areas, but you need more than just a couple. You know, there's certainly enough public buildings around town with the parking lots where people could, you know, pull in their vehicles or whatever. But, you know, it's just better to let them spread out. I think you have far less trouble than if you just try to keep this group of people who, in many cases, are very marginal anyway, in both health-wise and mental-wise and all that, in trying to keep them in a very tight, tight confined area.
Mm-hmm. What about several small campgrounds? And I'm thinking mainly not of people in vehicles who now have the option, if this passes without amendment in July, I guess that'll be, if it actually comes back to City Council on the 13th, and I continue to have some doubts about that, but hopefully I'm wrong, or hopefully my doubts are, you know, unnecessary. Still, that's going to leave two-thirds of the homeless population, those who don't have vehicles, outside. Now, it will be legal for them to pull up a piece of sidewalk in those areas, but what are you going to do when it rains? You know, what are you going to do if you want to light a fire? Or, I mean, you know, these questions, I think, haven't been answered. Do you have any thoughts on those?
Well, I still think there are areas, and of course, I haven't been in Santa Cruz for a while, but I don't think it's that overly populated yet. But I still think you have a lot of green area that where people could, you know, have a little camp. You know, I mean, while I say I don't believe in a large organized campground, I don't have a problem with a camping site or a camping place mm-hmm. where somebody could put up a tent. I mean, is Sycamore Grove still there?
I believe so, although you have a lot of pressure from environmentalists who are concerned that, you know, camping, which is not not even regulated, but camping in wilderness areas at all. They don't want any camping in wilderness areas. They want, you know, they're concerned about the area being despoiled, all these greenbelt people.
Mm-hmm. Well, and then you've got the state parks, you know, you've got several state parks right around there that are not... In the wintertime, they're not that heavily used.
Mm-hmm.
We tried to work something out with that. I mean, in many ways, I think the state was a little bit trying to work with us a little bit, we thought, and then they kind of shut it all down. So, I mean, I think there's a lot of options, you know, but that is a good point, you know, it just seems that somehow we have to reach a happy medium between not having a large organized campground versus having something where people at least could put up a tent and have a little campfire or whatever.
And I understand you're going to be coming back to town sometime next month.
We're going to bring our grandson out.
And are you going to be holding a public kind of memorial to the fast and commendation to David Silva and others for their successful work on the sleeping ban repeal?
Well, you know, I'm not too mobile these days, but I will be holding up at what I thought was led to believe it was still the Dream Inn, but it's not there anymore. It's something else. So, but I'm going to, but we're going to bring our grandson out to show him where we used to live, work.
Now we'll rent the Civic Auditorium for you, so you can make a speech.
Oh, okay. I look forward to seeing anybody and everybody. I'll leave it up to you to get people together. Maybe we can meet somewhere where do we used to haunt of people? Are you still banned from a lot of these places?
The Bookshop Santa Cruz is still threatening to arrest me if I go in, but the Java House has relented.
All right.
Thanks to the Steve Argue Defense Committee.
All right, great. We can go there.
We've been talking to Jane Immler, or Calamity Jane, as she used to call herself. She's out there in Missouri, nursing along on half a kidney, but still with us. And I guess you're coming out. We finally convinced you to come out here in, what's the date, June?
I think we get in June 20th, I think.
June 20th or 21st. So if anyone who remembers Jane from the old days or is interested in knowing more, having heard this interview with her, can give a call to 423-HUFF, 423-4833, and we will get you a front row seat in what could be, you know, one of the largest gatherings in our time.
Okay, well, Robert, it was great talking to you, and Santa Cruz, I'm looking forward to seeing you again, and you know, keep up the good work. I don't think you'll be sorry. You know, maybe Santa Cruzans can sleep a little better at night if they know that everybody in town can sleep legally.
I would hope so.
Okay.
Thanks, Jane.
Okay, bye-bye.
Rosebud died to set you free, although you did not want to be. Though she made it hard to see, Rosebud. Rosebud died for you. Rosebud died to make you care about poor people everywhere with their desperate, hungry stares. Rosebud died for you. Rosebud died to make you stop. Died to wake you with a shock. Died to stop this bullshit talk. Rosebud died for you. Rosebud died to make you see that people suffer needlessly. This ain't how it's supposed to be. Rosebud died for you. She had to do. Rosebud died for you. Rosebud died to let you know that some things you just can't let go. Let a thousand new parks grow. Rosebud died for you. Rosebud died for you. Rosebud died for you.
Michael Sheridan. Michael Sheridan.
I don't remember what the
title. We have Park, the police officer's friend. I don't know, the local. How would you describe yourself? You're going to warn some people about the beer situation.
Beer is bad if there are police officers around in People's Park.
This is Lisa Stevens, who's been fighting for People's Park for years. And Lisa, what's happened in the last year that might interest us other than this much ballyhooed referendum?
Well, the volleyball court has undergone a transformation. It no longer exists as a volleyball court, and it's going to be a beautiful pergola, which is an overhead trellis. So all the wood from the volleyball court that still remains is being turned into something really beautiful for plants to hang on to.
When are they going to turn the bureaucrats into useful members of society?
I think we're going to have to wait a very long time.
Well, what about the... is the park still closed at night? Are homeless people still harassed for sleeping here?
Yeah, it's still pretty bad. You can't hardly rest here. The police are still enforcing the rules about what a mattress is, meaning if it's more than about 2 inches, they can tell you to roll it up and go somewhere else. The other thing that's happening is that...
Is this some sort of yogi thing where they're helping you to get into a more meaningful existence by thinner mattresses, a sort of a ascetic self-improvement program?
Well, it would only be that if they were practicing it themselves, but of course, heaven forbid that anyone who thought that it was a mattress should actually have to lie on something that thin in a park. But the other thing that's happening is this... the contract. There's a contract to manage the park between the university and the city. So basically, every year, the university gives the city a bunch of money to hire people to pick up the trash and to run the recreation program, which is all very good. It's a good thing. The bad part of it is that this year, during the renegotiation, which is happening right now, the university has decided that we don't need a full-time recreation coordinator. What we really need is a park manager. And what the park manager would do would be to enforce the rules, which, of course, they think are not being enforced adequately, which includes the 2-inch mattress.
You need somebody with a tape measure, keep on the job training here, sort of keeping an eye on those widths and thicknesses.
Yes, and make sure you aren't carrying too much stuff with you, you know, or bringing a shopping cart in here. All those things are still forbidden, according to the university and the city.
Now, who designed these rules?
Unfortunately, I had a part in this. I tried to keep them as undraconian as possible, but it was the useless committee, the Youth Standards and Evaluation Advisory Committee, which no longer exists. And this is a lesson for everybody in having consequences when you do things that you think are the right thing.
So when did these rules come into being?
You would ask me that. Probably 7 years ago, maybe.
Right. That long
five,
ago.
5 years.
I remember being a part of a committee meeting where you were trying to write a letter to the new chancellor about, I don't know, eliminating the slap suit or eliminating the defamation suit or eliminating one of those suits.
We wrote a lot of letters like that to which there were no response, but yeah. The current advisory board is even weaker than the youth committee. And there are some good things to be said about having a weak committee, but it's really a shame that the university involves really, you know, good-hearted people who mean well and want to contribute in these things. They give them advice, and they don't follow it. If you take a look at, we just had lights installed in the east and the west ends of the park, and they had design workshops, you know, charrettes, where all these people participated. They took field trips and looked at different kinds of lights and brought in stuff. And then they just went in and installed these things, which are 4x4 wooden posts with the ugliest fixture you've ever seen on the top. So, you know, it's the university's basically the alcoholic father to a fairly dysfunctional family, but the family sure works a whole lot better than the father does.
So what's the community's response to all this? I mean, let me put it this way. Is the park, it seems to be at least still existent. What's in the future for the People's Park?
Oh, the future for People's Park is bright and beautiful and very, very green. I think now the student referendum was just the latest piece of this thing where everybody was sure that students would vote against the park. And I didn't think they were going to. No student body's ever done that. Every time there's been a confrontation, it's energized students and brought them into the battle. But it's time to stop fighting this war. We don't need to do this anymore. And the only way that's going to happen is if the university gives up the land once and for all. And I think that should be the next step, a national landmark and ownership by a land trust or another governmental agency that will keep the park as open space in perpetuity.
Has this been proposed before?
Yes.
When was the last time it was formally proposed and brought forward?
Last year.
So it hasn't been proposed until 30 years after the park was created?
Oh, no. The first time was in 1968, before the park existed.
They decided they'd had enough of the mud holes, and they wanted something here instead.
Well, the university used eminent domain, and then they tore down everything and made people move their houses and left it this way. The city council voted 4 times in 1968 to ask the university to let the community have the property, to use the property for a community open space for a park.
Well, you're talking to an old People's Park researcher, and I didn't even know that. Where did you get this startling bit of information?
Berkeley City Clerk's Office.
So it was original research on your part?
Mine and Catherine Liu, who used to work for the mayor.
Have you written anything about the history of People's Park that might be useful for people to read?
Well, I'm hoping that our website will actually have more up-to-date information. There's a brief history on there, but we're working on getting that together. And Claire Birch is she's been working on a book for years. But I thought about writing stuff, and I haven't actually done it yet.
I did an elaborate chronology of People's Park, unfinished, of course, but including, I think it was 30 or 40 pages long, which I'd be happy to scan into you if you want to put it on your website. Or it's based on Daily Cal articles and old stories from this paper and that.
That would be excellent. That would be very helpful.
I will give you a flyer, actually, and you can, if you get in touch with me, I will make an attempt to do it, but only if you get in touch with me.
I'll do that. I promise.
Anything else happening around Berkeley we should know about? Weird police behavior, exciting new social movements, strange religious cults?
Weird police behavior is always happening. The downtown is being slowly sold off store by store to chains and high-end retailers and eateries. A lot of our local businesses are gone. They just had a huge ribbon cutting for Kinko's at the corner of Bancroft and Shattuck, which I have no idea what the Economic Development Department was thinking, since, after all, we have dozens of small family-owned coffee shops that people should be supporting. But they had a ribbon cutting ceremony, and they had city officials, and it was really weird. But
Kinko's.
Kinko's is what we want downtown Berkeley to be known for.
Talking to Mama Bears earlier today about how there have been, I think, 12 bookstores have failed in the small bookstores in the last 2 years. And in the last 2 years, 35% of all feminist bookstores have closed in the United States. 40% of all small bookstores have closed in the last 5 years. Amazon.com and, of course, the big chains are to blame. And they will drag it down. They're losing money every year, these chains and these and the Amazon site, but they're doing it simply to destroy their competition, at which point, of course, presumably, they will raise their prices.
Well, the stores that can hang in there, if they can stay open, I think that if they get their websites and whatnot set up, that they're going to out-compete Amazon eventually. And, I mean, with a lot of the other businesses, that's what's being shown. I've talked to some of the bookstore owners here in town, and they think they're going to be okay.
I know, well, skipping to another subject, the Police Review Commission has been engaging in some forums lately. What's that all about?
I don't know.
Aha. Steering clear of that shit.
We've been having roundtable discussions on the war on drugs, which, of course, is not really a war on drugs because the drugs aren't going to jail. The people are. And
jail Thorazine immediately.
Jail Thorazine immediately. I can
nicotine people, kill them now, not later, and burn their billboards. That's my idea.
But the roundtable discussions have really, they've been good because they've involved a lot of people who normally wouldn't even be discussing this from all parts of the community. And it's been very low-key. And I'm hopeful that the policy statement that was actually written by a collection of people, some of whom are on the Police Review Commission, is wonderful, and people should get a copy of that and read it.
Berkeley in 79 made marijuana enforcement its lowest priority. Are they still doing that, or are they pulling the kind of shit they're pulling in Santa Cruz, which is that selling a gram of marijuana is now a felony?
Well, they haven't actually changed the law, so it's still the lowest priority technically on the books, but 85% of the drug arrests in towns are actually for small amounts of marijuana.
Strange.
So it's not their lowest priority, but they haven't upped the penalty so that people are just not, if you've gotten arrested for it, you know, but or gotten a ticket for it, you know, but otherwise people don't really realize that the ordinance that was passed is being ignored, essentially.
Flouted by the police department.
Flouted is a good word, yes.
Well, I appreciate the update there. Do you wish to sum up or give us some words of hope or possibly a gloomy after comment?
Oh, no, I think the other positive thing is there's a wonderful person running for U.S. Senate against Dianne Feinstein and Tom Campbell. That's Medea Benjamin. She's a Green Party candidate.
Uh-huh.
With a global exchange and the World Trade Organization demonstrations. So I think that's very positive for all parks and green outlooks.
Hey, we've been talking to Lisa Stevens, whose official position is?
Gardner.
Beer drinker Warner of the...
No, not beer, Gardner. With a little G. Gardner with a little G.
A lot of ribbing from Santa Cruz Free Radio. Thank you, Lisa.
Not to be confused with Chauncey Gardner.
And we are going back to the Santa Cruz City Council's sleeping ban repeal debate from May 23rd, but that was an interview from April with Lisa Stevens, Gardner and People's Park activist, on the 23rd anniversary. 23rd? No, must be the 33rd, 1969, 31st anniversary. Anyway, it's one of those anniversaries of People's Park that happened last April, and we try to give you a little Berkeley update to compare with what's going on in Santa Cruz. In Berkeley, it is illegal to sleep in a vehicle now, and so hopefully we can actually light the way for Berkeley, and as I said, serve as a beacon rather than get this ridiculous metaphor about us being a magnet. I don't think it's going to be a magnet. I think it'll be a beacon. And I think other cities will come under not just in pressure, but also encouragement to take action to decriminalize sleeping in vehicles or legalize sleeping in vehicles, if you will, for those who need to do so. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. I'm your host, Bathrobe's Pierre Robert Norris. This is 96.3. Call-in number is 427-3772. Voicemail, in case you want to leave a message for Free Radio, 427-4523. Call me off-air, or if you want to reach my producer, she's on that line now at 423-HUFF, 423-4833. HUFF is an acronym for Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom. If you're a writer, Post Office Box 7507 will get you Free Radio Santa Cruz, P.O. Box 7507-95061. Or if you want to shortcut it and do an email, it's frsc@microradio.net. Website www.microradio.net/frsc. Any of these numbers I would be happy to get back to you on if you want to call 423-HUFF. And in the meantime,
Let's hear from Mayor Sugar on May 23rd and the Council on the historic sleeping ban repeal debate, discussion, presentation. It wasn't much of a debate, it's got to be said. The City Council made absolutely no changes in the proposal, passed it completely without a comma being altered. It made one think that, in a way, the public comment is kind of irrelevant to the City Council, as indeed, and I fear this is true, it has been on a number of other issues. It's not that I don't favor the proposal as it's passed, though I've already given my criticisms. It's certainly better than nothing, though it should be strengthened. It's just kind of disquieting to see how little interest the City Council takes in what's said by the community.
So we view as the sine qua non of this proposal, as the backbone of this proposal, the fact that we have got to manage, regulate, and program those areas where the homeless will be sleeping. This is not a situation where people can come in from out of town or from within town, bed down, and just sleep with no expectation. The City Council is going to take a number of steps to make sure that these areas are actively managed, that the homeless community that is taking advantage of these safe sleep areas are actively assisted, actively policed, and that the concerns of the commercial neighbors, the industries that are there, are going to be addressed on a continuing and regular basis. We're proposing to do this in several ways. First of all, at its budget hearings last week, the City Council voted unanimously to establish an unprecedented full-time position in our police department. That will be a homeless services resource officer. We've never had a position like this. The sole duty of this sworn police officer will be to police and assist the homeless communities and deal with issues pertaining to the homeless community, not just in these two industrial areas, but throughout the city. We've never had a position like this. It is hoped, and by the way, this was a recommendation of the Homeless Issues Task Force, a unanimous recommendation. It is our hope that with this unprecedented resource, we will be able to proactively manage any problems that may result from the activities that would occur in these two industrial parks, so that we can nip any problems in the bud before they become chronic or acute for any particular business or people. The other thing that we have a very solid understanding of here is that that homelessness is not an acceptable condition. Homelessness, in 99% of the case, is an involuntary condition where people find themselves in the throes of some misfortune and live unwillingly on the streets. Our program is going to aggressively address these people by providing outreach, vocational outreach, substance abuse outreach, and casework, so that we can get to these people, focus them, channel their resources, and hopefully get them off the streets. And that really, to me, is at the heart of this program. Right now, we don't have the resources to get to the homeless because they're scattered throughout the city.
You're listening to Mayor Keith Sugar talking about the safe sleeping zones, and maybe you're getting as nervous as I am as he talks about all this case-managed stuff that he has as a bright idea in his bonnet. None of this is in the law that he is proposing, but I'm afraid that a lot of it is not just PR talk for the businesses. A lot of it is a real kind of concern he has and a belief or misapprehension that homelessness is primarily some kind of defect in the people who are homeless, whether it be a drug abuse problem, an alcohol abuse problem, a so-called mental illness condition, that this is something that you can fix these defective people and help them out if only you can herd them into one area and work on them one by one, register them, send them to the right experts, and so forth. This is the kind of thing I heard from him a couple years ago when he was running for city council, that he not only wanted to end the sleeping ban, he wanted to do more than that. He wanted to end homelessness. He felt that that was what needed to happen. And certainly I agree with the idea of ending homelessness, which of course the primary approach for doing that is housing and jobs, but you don't hear anything about housing and jobs in this speech. You don't even hear anything about campgrounds. In fact, later on, Mayor Sugar specifically repudiates Michael Hernandez's admittedly special pleading and I think relatively insincere suggestion of a campground. by saying there's no place for homeless people for a campground, which I think, of course, is preposterous. But, and I know that Jane Immler disagreed with me. You heard Jane Immler, a homeless activist from the 80s, really sort of the grandmother of the homeless activists, talking on this issue. So I am taking an issue with her on that one. I think that we can have campgrounds provided they're not micromanaged and provided there are a number of them and provided they're relatively loose. I think those are possibilities that would be an improvement over our current situation. But the idea that this should be hooked up, that people cannot sleep without elaborate case management and involvement in a system supposedly to help them out as though they were the defective products of our society, is, I think, not going to fly with the homeless community. It's not going to work even with among those whom it does fly. And it's if it's more than a PR statement to the business community, it does alarm me. I want to suggest that people who are listening to this show might want to call in and give me their thoughts, 427-3772. I'm going to continue playing Mayor Sugar's his actual presentation on May 23rd when he went into the proposal to end the sleeping ban in some parts of the city.
That presents another problem, obviously, is that oftentimes people camp next to residences, next to businesses, and it creates a large real or perceived problem for the businesses or people next to the homeless. What this measure will do is it will give the homeless a place to go. It will give them a place to go where we can focus the resources designed to get them off the streets on them. And at the same time, it's going to give relief to the neighborhoods and the business areas that feel the impacts of the homeless situation here in the city of Santa Cruz. So this is really a win-win situation that we are seeking to implement to make good on the Chamber's recommendations and the recommendations of the Homeless Issues Task Force. It is our expectation that the measure will result in a more successful rate of intervention with the homeless, in a higher rate of turnover of the homeless population, getting them back into mainstream society quicker, that it will result in amelioration of homeless-related problems in the neighborhoods and the business areas, and through aggressive management, will result in amelioration of the homeless problem being experienced actually within the industrial parks themselves. Right now there is no management regime there. There is no manner of policing, control, or assistance for the rather significant homeless populations that are in the industrial parks right now. Part and parcel of this proposal is to provide those services, to provide porta-potties, to provide trash cans, and again, the human resources necessary to alleviate what again is a perceived or real problem that the businesses in these industrial areas feel from the homeless populations in this area.
Again, voluntary services, porta-potties, trash cans, great idea. I mean, long overdue, should have been happening years ago. But then his references to alleviating the problems that businesses have makes one wonder what he's talking about. Is he talking about some kind of increased enforcement in order to somehow give substance to the paranoid apprehensions of some businesses who would prefer to see no homeless people within a 30-mile radius? It's not clear exactly what he means by this. And I'm not saying he means this or he means that. I'm just made uneasy by this kind of talk. And again, as I said, uneasy by the fact that if you follow this debate down to its end, as I did, it's not in a debate. He just simply presents his proposal and then he passes it with the city council majority. Sugar is the man who has said in the past he won't introduce such a measure unless he has the votes to pass it, and he did have the votes to pass it, so he didn't need to modify it at all. He didn't even really need to listen to criticism about it. And that makes one wary, because people in autocratic positions who have that kind of power are known to misuse it. And indeed, Mayor Sugar has repeatedly misused power around the public process. He's refused to let people speak. He's had people singled out and arrested, like James Ney in April at the city council sleeping ban debate. He has It's the Brown Act primarily, the allowance for the public to participate in real public process instead of behind closed doors, that he really has most seriously and most repeatedly violated, and indeed did so as recently, as I mentioned, as Wednesday, the day after this session, and when City Council had a special session with the Homeless Issues Task Force's report looking it over. So he is a man that has to be carefully watched. It's not that I don't agree in great part with a lot of his political positions, but that cannot excuse excluding the public from the real discussion of what's going on and taking a kind of an elitist view as to the situation. He's also a very passionate person who tends to, I think, fly off in different directions based on his impulses of the moment. And for a person in power to... Stay tuned for Patrick Spears Broadsides. As I went out one evening down Columbus Avenue, all the sushi bars were shuttered, dark canteens too. And I stood there in the darkness as an empty cab rolled by. Once I heard the sound of yuppies in the sky.